Thank you for listening to our Emmanuel Baptist Church podcast sermon series by Pastor Sean Cole. Emmanuel exists to display God's glory, declare God's gospel, and to disciple for God's great commission. If you have any questions about this message or would like more information about our church, you can visit our website at www.ebc-online.org. Now here's Pastor Sean.
37, Genesis chapter 37. We're back in Genesis. We took a break for a few weeks, but we're back in this book. And I debated how I was going to start the sermon this morning. I tossed it to and fro, but I'm going to go ahead and start it the way I thought I was going to start it, and we'll see where it goes. This past week on Facebook and in the internet world, there's been some viral videos that have gone on about a pastor's wife of a large mega church in America that made some comments about what she believes is our purpose in life. And basically she said it's all about us being happy. And God wants us to be happy, and everybody wants us to be happy. And if God's happy, if you're happy, and so we're not really there for worship for God, we're there for us to be happy. Now, I don't know what you think about that, but it was ironic because this past Tuesday in our men's study, our Tuesday morning men's study, we're going through the Gospel of John, and we came across this passage on the lips of Jesus, and I thought it was just interesting in light of all the things that are going on in our world today. John 15:20 says this. This is what Jesus says. Remember what I said to you. A servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. And earlier, Jesus says, if they hated me, they're going to hate you. Now, we live in a culture that wants us to be healthy, happy, and hot. Some of you aren't catching the hot part. You know, washboard abs, perfect skin, supermodel body. We live in a culture that wants you to be happy at all costs, healthy at all costs, and hot. And if you're not healthy, happy, and hot, you're just not a self-fulfilled person. This is your ultimate goal in life, is for everything to revolve around you having a successful and glorious and enjoyable life. So here's my job as your pastor. It's my goal as your pastor to help you in this culture to suffer well. The question is not if you're going to suffer. The question is, when are you going to suffer? And as you suffer, are you going to suffer well for the glory of Christ? That's the real question. Listen to James chapter 1, verses 2 through 4. Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds. For you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness, and let steadfastness have its full effect that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. Count it all joy, brothers, when you face trials. Count it joy. Romans chapter 5, Paul says, not only that, but we rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that our suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope, and hope does not put us to shame, because God's love has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has been given to us. These verses are countercultural. Count it joy when you suffer. Count it joy when you face trials of various kinds. When you're persecuted, when you suffer, when you go through hardships, count it as joy. Why? Because God's molding us into His image. God is making us look more like His Son, Jesus, when we go through trials. Romans 8:28 is probably one of the most famous passages in the New Testament. A lot of you hang your hats on Romans 8:28. And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good for those who are called according to His purpose. Do we truly believe that? That all things work together for good. What happens if those all things involve your suffering, your tribulations, your trials, your frustrations? Why do bad things sometimes happen to God's people? Why do we suffer from time to time? Why do we have to go through trials as God's people? Why do we have to go through the crucible of suffering? as we re-engage with the book of Genesis, we'll see the life of Joseph, a man who went through the crucible of suffering and came out on the other end for God's glory. But God had to take him through the ringer in order to get there. As we look at the tail end here of Genesis, we've been in Genesis a year now. Genesis 36 through 50, it's the story of Joseph. We're going to see the providence of God. We're going to see the power of God. We're going to see a man who went through suffering. We're going to see all of these things happen in the life of Joseph. And what I want us to do is I want us to be challenged as we look at the life of Joseph for us to look at God's sovereignty, God's power, God's providence, look at suffering, and for us just to engage this topic and say, how are we going to be prepared to suffer well? Because every single one of you in this room is going to go through some type of suffering. Some may be more extreme than others, but all of us are going to go through times of trial. Our faith is going to be challenged. God's going to sovereignly work out events in our lives that maybe make us go through a crucible of trial. And the question is not if we're going to go through those things. The question is, when are we going to go through those things? And the real question is, how are we going to suffer well? And so I want us to just kind of go deeper into the book of Genesis, and I want us to look at these things. What if God's plan for you is that He wants you to look more like Jesus. And the way He does that is through suffering, through trials, through tribulations. So that on the other side, when you come out, you're more holy, you're more purified, you're more refined, you look more like Jesus. So let's dive into Genesis chapter 37. I'm excited that we're back in Genesis. This story that we're introduced with Joseph divides itself into four scenes. Four little mini scenes, if you will, in this narrative, in this story. So let's look at scene one. Scene one is simply titled, "The Dreamer is Hated." Let's look at chapter 37, verses 1 through 11. The dreamer is hated. Jacob lived in the land of his father's sojournings in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now Israel, that's just another name for Jacob, if you remember, loved Joseph more than any of his other sons, because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a robe of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peacefully to him. Now Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, "Hear this dream that I've dreamed. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheaf arose and stood upright, and behold, your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf." And his brothers said to him, "Are you indeed to reign over us? Are you indeed to rule over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Then he dreamed another dream and told it to his brothers and said, "Behold, I have dreamed another dream. Behold, the sun, the moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me." But when he told it to his father and to his brothers, his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you've dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come to bow ourselves to the ground before you?" And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. This is the new section of Genesis. It begins with the story of Joseph. Now, we've not been in Genesis for a while, and we looked back at the life of Jacob. And Jacob had a lot of good moments with the Lord. Jacob's name was changed to Israel. God had revealed himself to Jacob, but Jacob still had some issues. One of the big issues that Jacob struggled with was favoritism. He loved Rachel more than Leah, and here we find him loving Joseph more than the other brothers. And so the story of Joseph starts with him as a 17-year-old teenager. Joseph is a 17-year-old teenager when this story starts, and he's out in the fields, he's pasturing the flock with the two concubines of Jacob's sons. Now, I hope you noticed something when we read this first portion. How many times does the word hated show up in the text? Three times, and then there's the word jealous. In verse 4, they hated him. In verse 5, they hated him even more. In verse 8, they hated him even more. And then in verse 11, they are jealous of him. So, four times in this passage, we see this hatred, this jealousy escalating. It keeps getting ratcheted up. It's not just some passive-aggressive behavior, but this is boiling rage and anger and hatred that these brothers have that eventually lead them to want to kill their brother Joseph. So we have to ask the question, what keeps this anger, this hatred escalating? What causes these brothers to hate Joseph so badly? Well, we see four things in this text that emerge as why they hate him. Why is the dreamer hated? Well, first of all, Joseph brings a bad report to his brothers. Notice what it says there in verse 2. Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Joseph brought a bad report. Now, it doesn't tell us what the bad report was. We don't know what Joseph did. But we see here that Joseph is a little tattletale. Now, I'm sure the brothers were doing something wrong. But instead of allowing his dad to deal with his brothers, Joseph says, I'm going to bring a bad, an evil, actually the original language, report. The word report used in the Hebrew text really means a disparaging report. A report meant to cast disparaging comments on the brothers. And so here you have this pesky little brother, this little upstart tattletale, that's going to his dad and saying, Dad, look what these guys are doing. So strike number one, he's a tattletale, and they don't like that. Strike number two, Joseph is loved more than the other brothers. Jacob shows intense favoritism, the text tells us. Look at verse 3. Now Israel, that is Jacob, loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a robe of many colors. This is the famous coat of many colors. Now, before we start talking about the coat of many colors, let me talk about clothing. From here on out, track the clothing. The clothing is going to tell the story in the Joseph narrative. So when we go through this, we need to pay attention to who's wearing what. The clothing tells the story. And right here we have the motif of clothing, the coat of many colors. Now, it's really kind of hard to translate what this coat was, but many scholars believe it was a long-sleeved coat that flowed down like this long outer garment that was probably embroidered or had embedded in it some ornamented type of jewelry. It's not overalls, okay? It's not like he's going to wear this as he goes out and works in the fields. It's probably like our modern day, like, think of like some like fashion dude walking down the streets of New York with a long fur coat on or something. Like nobody does that here in Sterling, but just picture somebody wearing like this long, wonderful coat of many colors. Now, here's what it really symbolized, though. It symbolized royalty. Jacob is crowning Joseph with royalty. He's putting this robe on him saying, you're my favorite son. You're my royal son. You're the son that I'm doting upon. I'm going to crown you with royalty. Now, strike number two. If you're one of these other brothers, like, how come I didn't get a coat? I just have this sleeveless tunic that I've got to work in. It's made of camel hair or something. I don't know, goat skin. It's really scratchy. All right. Notice what it says, though. They hated him and could not speak peacefully to him. We don't know what they said to Joseph, but they couldn't speak peacefully to him. They hated him. Passive-aggressive, we don't know if they had conversations where they got in his face and yelled at him. But tension is hot in the family. And to make matters worse, Joseph has a dream. Now let's stop and talk about dreams for a moment, because dreams are going to show up through the rest of the story here as we look at Joseph. Dreams always show up in pairs. There's always two dreams. And you have to ask the question, why are there two dreams? Well, here's why there's two dreams. If there's just one dream, it could have been an anomaly. It could have been a fluke. It could have just been this fly-by-night. Maybe there was some misunderstanding. The second dream comes along to confirm the truthfulness of the first dream. So they come in pairs so that the two dreams work together to say, this is real. This is going to happen. This is reality. And so what's the dream that Joseph has? Well, you know, these sheaves all bow down to him. He's in a position of authority and they're all bowing down to him. And notice what the text says in verse 5. Now, Joseph had a dream, and when they told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. Okay, so they hated him, and now they hated him even more. And then when he gets to the end of telling the dream in verse 8, they hated him even more. Now, if that's not bad enough to have one dream, the second dream is going to seal his coffin. He comes back, and this time he says, well, the sun, moon, and stars, you're bowing down to me. And Dad gets involved this time. And Jacob says, now, okay, you've gone a little bit too far, Joseph. Do you think our whole family is going to bow down to you? Now, I know I gave you the coat of many colors, but let's be realistic. We're not bowing down to you. So the brothers got jealous. The brothers are extremely hateful of Joseph. But notice what it says there in verse 11. His father kept the saying in mind. Why did Jacob keep the saying in the back of his mind? Jacob's been a product of a dream before, has he not? Jacob dreamed and saw the ladder to heaven and God coming down to him. And so Jacob knows that, there may be something to this dream. And I think the brothers freaked out, to be honest with you. Because the brothers have grown up in this family and they've heard the stories of dreams. Here's the big deal about dreams in the Bible. These dreams come from God. And these dreams are going to come true because they come from God. These brothers are balking at God's sovereign purposes because they know it's going to happen and they can't do anything to change it. And so instead of submitting to God's sovereignty, they try to fight it. It's the same thing today. We have people that try to fight God's sovereignty and don't submit to His purposes because they don't believe God's in control. They want to be in control. So the first act here, the first scene is, the dreamer is hated. He was hated. He was hated even more. He was hated even more. And his brothers were jealous of him. Okay, let's go to scene two. The dreamer obeys. The dreamer obeys. Verses 12 through 17. This is a short little scene, but it's important. Now his brothers went to pasture their father's flock near Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, are not your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them. And he said to him, here I am. So he said to him, go now and see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock and bring me word. So he sent him from the valley of Hebron and he came to Shechem. And a man found him wandering in the fields. And the man asked him, what are you seeking? I'm seeking my brothers, he said. Tell me, please, where they're pasturing the flock. And the man said, they have gone away, for I've heard them say, let us go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. Now, you have to remember back a few months. I know it's probably hard. And you have to ask the question, why in the world would these brothers go back to Shechem? Do you remember what happened at Shechem? Dinah was raped, and Simeon and Levi go out and kill the entire town. Not a good place for them to go back to. So Dad's probably thinking, I wonder if it's safe for my sons to be in Shechem. Let me do the unthinkable. Let me send my 17-year-old son, who they hate, all by himself on a 50-mile journey to see how they're doing in Shechem. And you're thinking to yourself, Jacob, are you clueless? Are you a terrible dad? What are you doing? You're sending your son into harm's way. But what does Joseph say? Here I am. 17-year-old boy charts off by himself. The text doesn't say he have a traveling companions with him. He's by himself, 17-year-old. He goes 50 miles from home and he begins wandering in this field looking for his brothers, and this man shows up. This nameless man. We don't know who this man is. This mysterious man. All the man says is, I know where they went. They went to Dothan, 25 miles away. So now Joseph has to go 75 miles from home. And all we see in this little section is that he obeys his dad. He's obedient to his father's command. And the father's command is pretty weird. Go by yourself, Joseph, to find the brothers that hate you in Shechem, the town where they slaughtered everybody, and see if everything's okay. Are you getting senile, Jacob, or what, in your old age? We don't know what's going on here. Okay, here we go. Scene three. If the dreamer obeys, scene three, the deceiver's scheme. Here's the heart of the story. Let's pick up in verse 18. They saw him from afar. And before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we will say that a fierce animal has devoured him, and we will see what will become of his dreams." But when Reuben heard it, he rescued him out of their hands, saying, "Let us not take his life." And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but do not lay a hand on him, that he might rescue him out of their hand to restore him to his father." So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the robe of many colors that he wore, and they took him and threw him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. Then they sat down to eat. And looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. And let not our hand be upon him, for he's our brother in our own flesh." And his brothers listened to him. Then Midianite traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. They took Joseph to Egypt. Now here's the dramatic tension at its highest. How do they know it was him from far off? The text says right there, look, they saw him from far off. How do they know it was him? He's wearing his coat. Joseph, are you thinking this through? Either Joseph's a clueless 17-year-old that's walking 75 miles in this nice coat, or he's trying to flaunt his stuff that he's got this coat. Either way, it's not a good situation. He's walking right into the trap. And notice that they conspire to kill him. From the time they see him coming, from the time that they reach him, they've already mob mentality conspired to kill him. And notice what they call him. Here comes that, in verse 19, that dreamer. Literally in the Hebrew text, it reads, that Lord of dreams, that King of dreams. Here comes that King of dreams. Let's throw him in the pit. Let's say that an animal slaughtered him, and let's go back and lie about it to our dad. That's the ticket. That's a good idea. But I want you to notice what they want to kill. Yes, they want to kill Joseph, but they also want to kill the dream. Notice what it says there. Verse 20, "Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we will say a fierce animal has devoured him, and we will see what will become of his dreams." If we kill Joseph, we can kill the dream of us one day bowing down to him. Because we don't want that to happen. But Reuben, the oldest brother, gets a conscience. No, let's not do this, guys. There's a better plan. Now, we have to ask the question, why all of a sudden does Reuben have a conscience? You have to go back a few weeks ago. Reuben was the one that committed incest and was cursed by his dad. So maybe Reuben's thinking, maybe I can win brownie points with my dad by like kind of coming into the rescue and bringing Joseph back and not having this happen. But the brothers overturned that decision. And we don't know what Joseph says when he walks up. The text doesn't tell us, but I can imagine he probably walks up and says, "Hey guys, it's me. I've been walking 75 miles. Dad wants to know how you're doing. This guy in Shechem kind of told me you were out here. Hey guys, what's going on?" No sooner can he spit this out than what does the text say? Verse 23. "So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him." That in the original text denotes violence. In other words, they're dethroning him. They're taking him off of his throne. They're taking that royal robe off of him, the robe of many colors, and they took him and threw him into a pit. The pit was empty, and there was no water. Now, what was this pit? What was this cistern? It was a huge bottle-shaped hole in the ground, probably 15 to 20 feet high. Had no water in it. And so their idea was, let's throw Joseph in there and he'll probably die of starvation, die of thirst, or maybe really a wild animal may come in and take him. But either way, it's a good idea because here's what they could do. We don't actually physically have to kill him with our hands. So we can walk off on a technicality. We didn't quote-unquote kill our brother. Technically, he just kind of fell into the pit. You see how they're kind of justifying their behavior here? And verse 25 shows us the extreme callousness of the brothers. I mean, why is verse 25 there? They sat down to eat. The guys are sitting around eating their Subway sandwiches. What chips did you get in your packet? Ruffles or I mean, they're sitting there talking about eating while their brother is in the pit. I mean, they've turned off all conscience. They're callous. How can you eat? How can you just sit down to eat when you've just almost killed your brother? Now, meals are going to show the story as well as clothing. The next time Joseph eats with his brothers, it's going to be a totally different situation. I'll leave you hanging for that. But it just so happens that right at the time, these Ishmaelite traders are coming by. Just the right time, these Ishmaelite traders are coming by. And Judah, the fourthborn, says, now wait a minute. We can kill two birds with one stone. Let's not leave him for dead and not get money out of it. Let's sell him into slavery and we can get a profit out of it. Notice what Judah says there. Verse 26, then Judah said to his brothers, what profit is it if we kill our brothers and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. The brothers hated him. The brothers were jealous of him. The brothers ate in cold, calculated callousness, and now they greedily sell him into slavery. And who do they sell him to? The Ishmaelites. You see the irony there? Who were the Ishmaelites? Ishmael was the illegitimate son of Abraham, as opposed to Isaac, that was rejected. And so he's being sold into the very people that were not part of his family, the Ishmaelites. Think about Joseph for a moment. 17-year-old. He's alone. He's naked. He's beaten. He's left for dead. He's in a hole. And he's probably wondering, why are my brothers doing this and when is dad ever going to come? He's been stripped. He's been beaten. He's 17 years old. Now, my son Aiden is 17. I can't imagine a 17-year-old going through what Joseph went through. What are 17-year-old kids supposed to be thinking about in life? Cars, girls, school, video games. I mean, there's just normal things. The 17-year-old boys aren't to be thinking about being beaten and stripped and almost left for dead by their brothers and sold into slavery. That's not what 17-year-old boys are supposed to be thinking about. And you want to scream at this moment, this is not fair. Why does this have to happen to Joseph? Yeah, he may be a tattletale upstart, but he didn't really do anything wrong. He just came to report and find out what was wrong with the brothers, and they leave him for dead. They sell him into slavery. This is not fair. But that's not the end of the treachery. There's a fourth act in this plot. Scene 4. A father is deceived. Now, let's just stop real quick before we read this. What was Jacob's name before he was Israel? Jacob. What does Jacob mean? Deceiver. It runs in the family. Let's see what the sons do to their dad, who's the master deceiver. Let's keep reading, verse 29. When Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph was not in the pit, he tore his clothes and returned to his brothers and said, the boy's gone, and where shall I go? Then they took Joseph's robe and slaughtered a goat and dipped the robe in the blood. And they sent the robe of many colors and brought it to their father and said, this we have found. Please identify whether it's your son's robe or not. Very convenient there. And he identified it and said, it's my son's robe. A fierce animal has devoured him. Joseph is without a doubt torn to pieces. Then Jacob tore his garments and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, no, I shall go down to Sheol, that's the grave, to my son, mourning. Thus his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold him into Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. Now, we don't know why Reuben was away, but Reuben comes back and Joseph's sold into slavery. He's thinking, what in the world? We're toast here, boys. And then they did what they wanted to do all along. They kill a goat, dip the coat of many colors in the blood of the goat, and take it to their dad and make their dad identify it. Now here's the irony. How did Jacob deceive his dad? Goat skin. Remember? How do these boys deceive their dad? The blood of a goat on a coat. What goes around comes around in this family. A family of deception. And Jacob believes the lie. Obviously, he must be dead. An animal must have torn him to pieces. He weeps, he mourns, he cries. He basically wants to die. He doesn't accept the consolation from his family. And here's what the brothers are thinking. We got away with it. We got away with it. We fooled our dad. Joseph's long gone. He bought the blood on the coat. We're scot-free. Now think about those nights when they laid on their pillow and they couldn't sleep because they were racked with guilt knowing that they had done this to their own flesh and blood. Does this describe your family? Genesis is full of dysfunctional families. We've seen it all along. And every time we go through these stories, we think, why in the world would God choose to show grace and love and acceptance to this family? These guys are crazy. They're liars, they're thieves, they're wicked people. Why would God choose this family? And then we have to stop and say, well, wait a minute. If God chooses this wicked family, then, wow, why has God chosen to show me love? Why has God chosen to show me grace? Why has God chosen to send Jesus to die for me? Now, you get to the end of the story and you think, where's God in all of this? Is God mentioned in this story? Find the name God in this story. Where's God? This is evil? The brothers do evil to Joseph? There's injustice? Why are bad things happening to Joseph? Where's God in the midst of all this? Why is God allowing this to happen? But there's a twist in verse 36. Did you catch it? Meanwhile, while all the stuff's happening back at home, it just so happens that Joseph was sold to Potiphar, the captain of the guard. Not just to any old Egyptian, but to one of the most powerful men in Egypt. Is this just a coincidence? Or does it have God's fingerprints all over it? God is behind the scenes in this story with His invisible hand of providence orchestrating these events in His sovereignty so that we can see how God works. Now, the Joseph story doesn't have any... there's no signs and wonders and miracles and flashy things. You almost wonder where God is when you read the story. But God's the hero of the story. And God's working out His sovereign will in the midst of all the evil that's happening in the story. Let's ask some questions. Who gave Joseph these dreams? The text doesn't tell us, but it was God. Who's this mysterious man that comes out to help Joseph when he's wandering around? The text doesn't tell us, but we know of another mysterious man that Jacob wrestled with one night. Why is the timing just right for Joseph to be wandering and then the man tells him to go to Dothan? And at just the right time, was it just a coincidence when Joseph is there in Dothan that his brothers, at just the right time when his brothers are selling him into slavery, this Midianite caravan comes at just the right time to sell him in just the right time into slavery, and not just into any old slavery, but to Potiphar? Is this all just a coincidence of blind fate that's just happening? No, it's not a coincidence. God may not be mentioned in this story, but God's fingerprints are all over the story. He's behind the scenes orchestrating these events to bring about His intended purposes. And nothing can stop God's sovereign purposes, even the evil that his brothers perpetrate against him. And God allows Joseph to go through this crucible for many, many years for God to accomplish his purposes. Again, my job as your pastor is to help you suffer well and for you to rest in the absolute sovereignty of God who works out all things according to his purposes. We see a picture of Jesus in this story. Do you see it? Just like Joseph, Jesus was the favorite son of his father, the beloved son. Just like Joseph, Jesus was hated by his own brothers. Just like Joseph, Jesus was betrayed with a few shekels of silver. And just like Joseph, Jesus was left for dead to die alone. But that's where the comparisons stop. Joseph was just a man, a sinful man. But he was the rejected son who later provided salvation for his family. Jesus is the greater Joseph. He's the rejected son who will eventually provide salvation for his people. Jesus was stripped of his royalty. Jesus was beaten. Jesus was left for dead. Jesus was thrown into the cistern of the cross, if you will. He was forsaken. He was rejected. He was abandoned so that you and I could never be abandoned or rejected. He was despised and rejected. What does Isaiah 53:5 say? He was despised and rejected by men. A man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised. He was hated, just like Joseph was hated. And we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed. Jesus was despised and rejected and suffered and was abandoned and was forsaken so that you and I would never have to experience that. And when he rose again from the dead, he rules and reigns as the ultimate king, the royal king, Jesus. So how do you suffer well? You look to Jesus who suffered in your place. And you look to Jesus who's absolutely sovereign. And you look to a God who you may not understand everything that's going on, but he's sovereignly working his purposes behind the scenes to its desired end for your good. Because Romans 8:28 says, all things work together for good. Now those all things may be things that are painful. Those things may be things that are uncomfortable or suffering. But God's working all things together for your good. And it may mean that you go through the crucible of suffering like Joseph to come out on the other end. And you look to Christ who went to the ultimate crucible of suffering, the cross, and came out on the other end of the grave as the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And we submit to him, and we suffer well because we can look to our Savior who suffered ultimately and is sovereign. So as we take the Lord's Supper this morning, let it be a reminder that Jesus was rejected and left for dead so that you and I would never have to be rejected or abandoned or left for dead. And this should drive us to our knees in worship this morning as we celebrate the Lord's Supper so that we can glory in the sufferings of the cross of Christ and in turn find the strength for us to be able to suffer well. And we can trust in God's fingerprints of sovereignty working behind the scenes to bring everything to his desired end so that all things work together for good for those who love Jesus and have been called according to his purpose. So let me ask you to bow your heads this morning as we prepare to take the Lord's Supper. In 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 28, it says, let a person examine himself then and so eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For anyone who eats and drinks without discerning the body and eats and drinks judgment on himself. So So let's spend some time in examination this morning. If there's sin you need to confess, now's a perfect time to go before the King of Kings, who can forgive you of all your sins and cleanse you of all unrighteousness. And you can find grace and joy in Him as we take the Lord's Supper. So spend a few moments in silent prayer.